Good morning. During Zazen, the last period of Zazen, I quoted some lines from the Song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi. When erroneous imaginations cease, the acquiescent mind realizes itself. Then I said something like, and how can we approach this acquiescent mind? But as soon as I said that, I thought of another Zen story. I wasn't planning on saying it, but anyway, I wasn't planning on remembering this other Zen story either. But this other Zen story says, this is an interaction between Nan Xuan and his teacher Zhao Zhou, two very great lions of our Zen tradition. And Nan Xuan asked Zhao Zhou, "What is the way?" And Zhao Zhou answered, "Ordinary mind, everyday mind is the way." And then Nan Xuan said, "How can I approach it? How can I get at it?" And Zhao Zhou said, if you try to approach it, you go away from it." If you try to approach it, you go away from it. So now I'm admonishing myself for talking to you that way in Zazen. Some other teaching came and reminded me of something contradictory to what I was saying. So there's a line in the also in the Jewel Mirror Samadhi that says, "Its speech is not yet correct." Its speech is not yet correct. Anyway, my point is that my speech during Zazen wasn't quite correct. So it's more like, I think, what is it like then? And it's more like, no, not approaching it. It's more like just sitting still and having patience and maybe something that someone could identify as acquiescent mind would start to flower. You know, it would flower, but it wouldn't have anything to do exactly with your approaching it. It would just have more to do with your being ready for it, being ready and available for that flowering to occur. Making yourself available or just being patient and just sitting with your breath, watching your thoughts arise and pass away. So I thought that I've been wanting to speak for a while about this text called the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, because it's a very difficult chant that we've inherited. And the reason it's difficult for us is it comes from a long time ago, in a faraway place. So it comes to us from the 9th century in China. So it comes to us, you know, from 1,000 years ago or more, and from a culture very different than our own, and far, and again, far removed in time. When people hear this chant, and we'll chant this chant today at noon service, people are mostly mystified by it, and because it contains a lot of metaphors and allusions that have nothing to do really with our contemporary culture, our contemporary life. This poem bears some explanation. It can benefit from some explanation, and I can't begin to explain it in the short time that I have to talk this morning. But I'd like to talk a little bit about the author of the text, and I'd like to talk a little bit about the title, The Song of the Gyalmir Samadhi. And maybe, I was thinking maybe when we have our sesshin later in December, I can continue talking about this text, so I can have more opportunity to bring out some things about it, and undertake, of course, my own study of it, more thorough study of it. Mio brought up the author of this text in a lecture he gave just maybe last month, I think. The author of the text is a Zen master named Dongshan. He lived in central eastern China, not far from where I traveled, actually, in the trip I took last spring. His teacher was a fellow named Yunyan. And Dongshan is a very important figure for Soto Zen practice because he is considered one of the two founders of what became Soto Zen later in China, or Shaodong Zen in China, and then Soto Zen in Japan. And so Mio talked about his Dongshan's enlightenment experience. And there's a story that Dongshan practiced for an unknown number of years with his teacher, Yunyan. And at some point, he was ready to leave his teacher, and it's not clear what he was going to do, but presumably he was going to go off and, you know, practice with somebody else or perhaps start his own teaching career. But he was very, it was a hard time. You're reading between the lines of these stories, it seems like this would be a momentous and charged occasion, that he would be leaving his teacher. Everybody was just walking in those days, so if you walked away and you kept walking a long way away, it was hard to return. So there was, actually, they felt like when he left, maybe he would never again see, they would never again see each other. So it was kind of, you could say, you know, a momentous and a moving occasion for Dongshan. He left his teacher, and he was presumably thinking a lot about his teacher. And he came, as he was walking, he came to a creek, and he looked down into the creek as he was crossing it on some sort of bridge. And he saw his own reflection in the water. And seeing his reflection, he had some sort of great awakening experience. And he composed a poem of awakening. And that poem is as so. Earnestly avoid seeking without, lest it recede far from you. So earnestly avoid seeking outside yourself, lest it recede far from you. Today I am walking alone, yet everywhere I meet him. This probably refers to his teacher, right? Everywhere I meet him. He is now no other than myself, but I am not now him. It must be understood this way in order to merge with suchness. He is now no other than myself, but I am not now him. It must be understood this way in order to merge with suchness. And so later he writes the Jhulmer Samadhi, which is a longer poem, and in that poem he includes a line, a couplet. The Jhulmer Samadhi is in couplets, so it's two line sections, and you'll hear that when we chant it. But in that poem he memorializes his experience at the creek, seeing his reflection. And so in the Song of the Jhulmer Samadhi, the lines are, the couplet is, "It is like facing a jewel mirror. Form and image behold each other. You are not it. In truth, it is you." It is like facing a jewel mirror. Form and image behold each other. You are not it. In truth, it is you. So one time, I had an experience like this. It wasn't an awakening experience, but it was kind of a profound experience. And at that time, I think I'd started practicing at this time. Yeah, I had started practicing this time. And for many years, I had had a mustache and a beard, I think, a little goatee. And I decided to shave it off. I don't know why, but I just decided that I would get rid of it. And I'd had it for a long time. And so I shaved it off. I cut it and shaved it. And of course you had, you know, some cream in your face and stuff like that, so you couldn't quite see what the result was going to be. And then, you know, I washed my face after the process and I looked in the mirror and I saw my father. And I don't mean that I just saw like how I looked like my father. I saw my father. My father appeared in the mirror for, you know, just that split second. I am not my father, of course, but the image in the mirror really was me. So it was kind of like that, just for that, you know, that split second. So this is a story about how we. It's a story about the self and the other. It's a story about subject and object. We have this we have this strong sort of perceptual enclosure that's always convincing us that. There is me, and then there's everything else. Right? There is this body mind, and everything else, and there's always some sense of separation. Always some sense of distance between what is me in what is everything else. So, in a sense, this is why we have Zen. This is why we have a practice called samadhi. Is to work with this relationship of subject and object, of self and other, to really continually examine that relationship and question that relationship. So samadhi, the term samadhi itself is an important part. That's the song of the jewel mirror samadhi. Well, we know what a song is, right? And we can sort of imagine what a jewel mirror is. We can certainly imagine what a mirror is. But samadhi is a technical term from India. And literally it means putting together. That's the literal rendering of it, to put together. And it's translated often simply as meditation. So it could be the song of the jewel mirror meditation, or it's also translated as concentration, song of the jewel mirror concentration. Another more elaborate translation is samadhi is the skillful. The translation I read said the skillful unification, of subject and object. The skillful unification. I'm not sure about unification, but the skillful understanding of the relationship between subject and object, and the skillful understanding of the intimacy of subject and object, would be a little bit more on the mark for me. So, based on Dongshan's awakening experience at the stream, at the reflecting pool, we could call what he experienced as, we could also call this the song of the reflecting pool awareness. Anyway, the song, this is the practice of the reflecting pool concentration, the reflecting pool meditation. And it's just like when we go to see, we see a reflecting pool or we see some kind of pond, say there's a wind blowing in this pond, across this pond. All we see in the pond is the surface. We just see the surface of the pond. We just see what's happening on the ripples, usually the ripples on the surface, and we don't see many reflections. But when the pool is quite clear and calm, and the wind is not blowing, at that time, we see reflections coming back at us. So this is, I think we can see kind of an analogy there to what we do when we sit down in meditation. When we sit down in meditation, oftentimes all we see is just thoughts and feelings, and thoughts about the past, present, and future. We see the surface of the mind. That's generally what most people's experience is. And because that's what their daily experience is, and it's not that much different when you sit down on a cushion, except that you start to notice that there's this constant train of thinking going on. Then as we sit and essentially our sitting practice encourages the wind not to blow and the ripples to calm down, and it allows some deeper reflection to occur. And there's a shift in the way that we see ourselves in that situation. And the shift that's made is that whereas in daily life we're quite enamored and absorbed in our thinking and feeling and trying to evaluate where we stand vis-a-vis others and so forth, in samadhi, we become attracted, instead of becoming attracted to thoughts and feelings, we can become more attracted to the samadhi itself. We begin to have this sense of a deeper experience, and there's something arises in us that wants to it wants to approach this. So it's tricky. It wants to approach this. It wants to go deeper into that reflective. But you then, of course, according to the other story, you have to be careful about your new love. You know, you had this love, which is called self-love in a lot of cases, and now you have this new love that's called samadhi, and so you have to I recommend having that, developing that love, and also that knowing that our whole life is going back and forth between essentially our two loves, our two passions. But the passion for the self can be modified or something by our passion for what is not the self, what is other than the self, what is our life just coming to us without without as much agency as we usually think is necessary. So, so this kind of comes out of some reading I did about this this song of the Jhumir Samadhi, and in this reading it was talking about two ways that this a metaphor of the mirror, the metaphor of the mirror being a metaphor for the mind. Okay, this is the song of the mirror awareness. So it's a song about the mind, really. It's a song about how the mind works, and it's a song about how the mind works in meditation. So according to this one author I was reading, named William Powell, who has translated Dongshan quite a bit, he said in the Tang Dynasty, there would have been two understandings of the mirror as a metaphor for the mind. And the one, on the one hand, it would be understood as a kind of underlying purity of the mind. Like there is a disturbed layer of the mind, kind of like that analogy I was talking about with the wind across the water. And then underlying that would be the pure, undisturbed nature of mind. So this would have been, you know, and so meditation being a technique, if you will, for contacting this more pure underlying essence of mind. So that was one understanding. And then there was another understanding that maybe arose just a little bit later. And that understanding was the metaphor of the mirror is that it's a little hard to explain, but it's like to take the standpoint of the mirror. So the mind of the meditator as the reflecting quality of the mirror. So a mirror, in this sense, just sees what passes in front of it. Just whatever passes in front of the mirror sees and has. We have this story. We have this story about the mirror, mirror on the wall. Who's the fairest one of all? But that's not the mirror we're talking. That's the opposite of this mirror, right? This is the opposite of the mirror we're talking about. This mirror is just the really mirror as mirror, which just sees whatever comes in front of it as it is. And so it just has this reflective, non-discriminative kind of function. And so you get this this sense of the mind of the awake person is seeing what is coming in front of it and having very little reaction, just letting experience come and letting experience go. Just reflecting back what it sees. And well, maybe that's enough. So anyway, I've been studying this, you know, this in preparation for this talk, and just as an exercise, I've kind of been thinking of myself as a mirror, you know, just as a mirror, and seeing seeing objects and I don't know quite how to explain it, but really, really seeing objects, like really letting objects be in my awareness. And I guess I've been thinking about this phrase, I am not it. It actually is me. And that's been, you know, to work with that actually has been very interesting. It actually is me. Well, that means that, you know, Tony is me, and Oscar is me, and also the speaker over there and the Tonka over there. And there's kind of a, this just to kind of, I don't know, play with that. to play with that is rather interesting and an intimate kind of way of because if you kind of turn towards objects that way, they assume a kind of new life. Anyway, then I came across this kind of wonderful, we're studying. I was so happy to come across this because our fall study period is on the Prajnaparamita. And I was so happy to come upon this because here's some lines from the 8,000 line Prajnaparamita that gets at this sense of taking the standpoint of the mirror or the mind as this reflective quality of. So, and I guess that there's something passive in it too, but also engaged. But anyway, the syntax of the Prajnaparamita is a little hard to. It's kind of difficult, really. But I'm going to read these lines, and then I'll try to say something about the lines. So this section says, "It is as with the reflection of an object in a mirror or in water. To whom does it not occur that the object which produces the reflection is near to me, but those who come along in that mirror or bowl are far from me? For that reflection of an object makes no discrimination. Just as a Tathagata, because he has forsaken all constructions and discriminations, finds nothing dear or not dear, just so a Bodhisattva who courses in perfect wisdom, for there is no discrimination on the part of perfect wisdom. Just as the Tathagata is one who has forsaken all constructions and discriminations, even so, perfect wisdom has forsaken all constructions and discrimination." So I think one of the other features of this is, and I think artists know about this quite well, is that we see if we have some reflecting. Let's say I have a bowl of water here. I could have a bowl of water.
A bowl of water here.
I can't see any reflections in this particular bowl of water. So that analogy did not work right there. But the thing is that if you look in a bowl of water and there is a reflection, or if you look in a pond and there's something and there is a reflection, the first thing we think is that reflection is an illusion. That's not real. That's not real. The real thing is the object, whatever, you know, the real object is the moon, right? But the reflection of the moon in the water, that's not real. But then, actually, if you think about it, and I think artists know this immediately, is that to the eye, which is if you just take the eye as a non-discriminating organ, and it looks at the reflection in the water, to the eye, the reflection in the water is absolutely as real as the thing that's being reflected. It's not far, and the other's not dear. You know, we think the thing that is is the real thing, is the dear thing, and the reflection is the not dear thing. But to the eye, the reflection is as real as the thing. So this has something to do with it, I think. It has something to do with this quality of mind that we can raise that is not discriminating, so that whatever comes before the eye is as real as the other thing that comes before the eye, and if we have that understanding, then I think there's something about that understanding that is a healing understanding. It's an understanding that puts together. It's an understanding that brings things together rather than it heals alienation. It heals this sense of separation. Because whatever ugly thing comes to the eye, that is what's coming to my eye. And ugly, of course, we've added. And whatever beautiful thing comes to the eye, that's just what's coming to the eye, but beautiful is what we've added. And then our tendency is to get caught by ugly and beautiful. So this is, I think, the point of our practice. I think a point that has a point, and I think the point is to heal. It is to repair. It is to repair the alienation between self and others, and the alienation between subject and object. We have this this arcane poem that we'll recite, and it's maybe hard to see that's what this poem is about when you recite it, because you get distracted by the many foreign metaphors that are placed in it. But the in a sense, all you really need to know is the title. You know, all you really need to know is that this poem is about the practice of the jewel mirror samadhi. And they sometimes are translated precious mirror awareness. And the more you practice this samadhi, the more precious it will be. And I think it will be healing to you and healing to other people. People that you meet will see that you're doing, they'll notice that you're doing this. And even though they don't know what you're doing, they do notice that you do this kind of work. you raise this kind of you point yourself in the direction of raising this kind of awareness in yourself. Non-dual awareness. Not subject and object aren't one thing. And they're not two things. So we're always working on that understanding. No. Well, I've taken up the whole time. I don't know if you want to say anything. If you'd like to, we can adjust the schedule if you'd like to make a question or comment on what I've said. Yes. Right.
Yeah, that was very helpful. Thank you.
You're welcome. There's this concept in also in some other texts of sympathetic response. So that also is like the mirror wisdom. Mm-hmm. It's like the idea that if there was a guitar over there, and I had a guitar here, and I played the G string and that's will vibrate subtly. Okay, so that's also like a little bit like the mirror wisdom with this reciprocity. Lessening the separation, that actually, according to the teaching, doesn't exist. Yeah.
Tim, your talking this morning gave me a different way of thinking about the jewel mirror. I've been fascinated with the chant. I told you over the year we've been doing, I've been wanting to understand it better. I found myself thinking, well, maybe the jeweled mirror is the author's way of saying whatever is reflected, whatever, is jeweled, is to be respected and honored. So the mirror reflects Jim, but it can also reflect a portion of the rug. And that we, like you said, apply the stories. Stories that go with it, but it's reflected.
Oscar.
I'm a little confused about the two understandings you cited that you read about the 9th century China.
One thing the author said was that the understanding of the mirror as just the basis of mind, the essence of mind, the purity of mind. That's one understanding. But the in his view, that was kind of a passive understanding. In his view, there was another more dynamic, and I'm not necessarily putting a value on passive or dynamic, but in the other, the focus was more on, there was a little more sense of interest or engagement with what passes in front of the mirror than in the mirror itself. So if you're just interested in the purity of mind, and you could become a little bit inward. You could become rather self-centered in a way in your practice. You know, I mean, I've noticed this tendency in myself, like when I sit a sesshin or something like that, become very interested in this calm, undisturbed quality of mind, and I want more of it, you know? I mean, it is so attractive. It is so rich. But on the other hand, you know, you have to get up from your cushion, and if you get up from your cushion thinking, well, now I have to leave this purity of mind, which I love, and, you know, deal with all this messiness, then, you know, that could be an error kind of in your practice. But if you think, well, the way I get to carry this forward, so maybe we can have both, you know, maybe we can really enjoy this pure quality in our sitting, but remember that when we get up, we're going to see other beings, we're going to engage with having our lunch or, you know, tea or something like that, and now we can bring out this other quality of the mirror, which is it just respects everything that comes right in front of it. It has no judgments, no discriminations about what comes in front of it, and so it really respects everything equally. I think it's like you can have both of these understandings, and maybe one is more on our cushion a little bit, and the other one is more maybe off the cushion a little bit, but I'm not even sure about that. But one is more dynamic, according to this author. And what he said is that essentially, and I think Mio has talked about this a few times, that essentially when you are like this, you don't have to do anything special, because just as you are in your thoroughly established, you know, samadhi of the mirror, is enough, and you will then be able to act correctly, function appropriately, you know, in the world. Now, this is all very much of an ideal, but still, and you know, he brought up the idea, and I think maybe you've met some people. I have had the opportunity to meet some people like this. My teachers, who you sit down with them, and you feel yourself so naked, because you feel like you are seen so thoroughly, and it's like you're looking in a mirror, you know, or it's like, yeah, like they're just a mirror, and it's they're just reflecting this great light. You know, and anyway, that's about as much as I can say. Yes.
No.
It is not me. You know, now you've got me.
I think it has something to do with two, but not two, not one. You know, I'm trying to understand it. Maybe it's not understandable.
It is like facing a jewel mirror. Form an image, behold each other. Right? You are not it. In truth, it is you. Yeah. And here's another, I'll give you another.
What did he say?
He said,
when he saw his own
I am not now him. He is now no other than myself.
So.
But I am not now him. Yeah.
I was right. I'm the diagram.
Yeah. Here's another one. Here's another one that might help. You are not Buddha, but Buddha actually is you.
The only thing I can actually, what was coming to my mind is once many years ago when I did do after a Sashin, you probably know the story, but I lay down in the sun on a log, and I really truly felt, you know, at one with the log, like there was no difference, but yet I was lying on top of the log, but I wasn't the log, and the log wasn't me, but we had a lot more in common than we had difference.
Yeah, I mean, I think we probably don't, well, maybe we don't need to establish thoroughly in our minds the meaning of this, but to establish the feeling of it, really, and the feeling is of closeness, of intimacy, you know, that intimacy is that's the important feeling of it.
But it is contrary because it's intimacy, but there's no self to be intimate. I mean, it is intimate, but there aren't two things.
That's why it's intimate. Yeah, Claire.
I am it is sort of a reductionist, like this is all I am it, but it is me is like, I feel it as like an expansion. So that's for me how it seems to work. If I'm trying to say I am this thing, it's like this is me and this it is a subset of me. So I can't say I am it, that's false, that's limiting. But if I'm saying this is me and this is me and this is me, it's like the cone goes out instead of in.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I hear it.
Mm-hmm. I think you hear it very well.
A very visual, the cone.
Yeah.
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 And it makes me think of Thich Nhat Hanh's poem too. You know, I am the prostitute. I am the
sea pirate,
yeah.
Mhm. Yeah. Thank you very much. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. We will have a 15-minute break now, come back for a short period of zazen, and then service. So come, we'll be sitting again at 25 to 2.